If you think about sort of what does a healthy, agile, adaptable, innovative company look like, it's people experimenting and trying new things regardless of sort of which position they're working in, right? You don't really want to silo it all into just one team.
Welcome back to Media Voices, everybody. We're the Media Focus podcast that takes a wry look at all the news and views from the media world this week. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
I'm Peter Houston.
And that extract you've just heard is from Robin Kwong, who is the newsroom innovation chief at the Wall Street Journal. So we talked about how his team developed features and innovations to help the Wall Street Journal's wider goals, how his background in reporting and data journalism has helped his approach to this role, and how he manages development remotely.
As we discussed last week, we try to make everything applicable to our mission to help people make the best bets around media business models. This week, unfortunately, it means that the business of media and the stories on which we report are completely indivisible from one another. So we have the justifiable protests and we have everything that's going on with Black Lives Matter in the US, which we're all completely in support of, but we are coming at this from an outsider's perspective, of which we are very keenly aware. So we're going to begin this week by talking about, well, why headlines actually matter. So the Philadelphia Inquirer ran a headline, "Buildings Matter Too," which is among the most tone-deaf things I think I've ever heard.
I thought this was an Onion headline when I first saw it.
I did.
Yeah. Well, that's the world we live in now, where Onion headlines are completely indistinguishable from reality. Yeah. So just some context then, Philadelphia is 42% of the population are black, but journalists at the Inquirer were obviously furious about that. So what's happened since? What was the kind of what has the fallout been from that ridiculous headline?
Well, I think they've got the slight problem with this as well, that the employee structure at the Philadelphia Inquirer doesn't reflect the local population structure. So they've got about 50 journalists of colour. They basically all said on Thursday, 44 of these journalists called in sick and tired. Mm. And they sent this open letter to management and they basically just said, this quote that they wrote was absolutely spot on. They just said, "We're tired of shouldering the burden of dragging this 200-year-old institution kicking and screaming into a more equitable age." And they said to me that they're tired of management saying that the progress the company's made and diversity, inclusion, every time they raise their concerns, and they're like, "This, we're just tired of it."
Mm.
What's ridiculous about this is that the story actually has a point. They're talking about historic buildings in Philadelphia, and if there is rioting or fires or whatever, then that is. It's not a good thing that these historic buildings are damaged, which there's a point to that. But to couch it in this Buildings Matter Too headline is insanity.
It completely
How
non-equitable
ridiculous.
With like human lives.
Oh, just insane.
But this is one of those things that when those things are being discussed in your editorial meetings, if you don't have a diversity of staff, nobody flags that and you then think it's a good idea to publish it.
But that is exactly it.
I mean, is this... I don't know enough about the Philadelphia Inquirer.
No, I don't.
Is it the sort of paper that might have done this for the controversy, as a lot of the UK papers would have done?
Well, the fact that they apologised very, very quickly about it suggests not.
Mm.
It sounds like it was just dumb.
And I think one of the things that, we can actually link this back to our mission is exactly Esther's point. Is unless you have a representative editorial team, you're missing out on the ability to communicate with these vast swathes of the population.
A lot of the concerns raised by the staff were basically that, they need to be able to reflect. Like, they're going to completely alienate their Philadelphia community if they keep doing stuff like this.
Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah.
How much do we talk about audience, about being able to connect and engage with your audience?
The one thing I would say, though, is that the Inquirer's publisher, Lisa Hughes, actually had the statement, she retracted this straight away and was just like, we shouldn't have done this. She sent around notes apologising for the piece, and she said that the staff that had taken the day off wouldn't lose any sick days or vacation days, and that they understood. And she put together quite a... we'll link to the piece in Newman Lab, but it was quite a good response about acknowledging the need for change.
Well... moving on now to the fucking nightmare that was an NYT story this week.
Well, so the Philadelphia Inquirer runs this headline, and the New York Times has this, like, hold my beer moment and publishes an op-ed by this Republican senator who wants the troops to be sent in. You know, whatever, that's a point of view. They used that as a headline. The headline was "Send in the troops."
So I've also seen something on this today that apparently that wasn't Tom Cotton's headline.
No, it probably wasn't.
The piece, and it was an editor that put that headline.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that.
Regardless of that, he's still.
Oh, he's not. He doesn't sound like a nice man.
No, he's talking about, if you read the piece, he's talking about no quarter.
Absolutely.
Militarily, that means you take no prisoners, you kill everybody.
The thing here, though, is that this happened, what, Wednesday this week? And the first thing the New York Times did is shored up their position. They were like, no, this is fine.
A.G. Sulzberger's response to us initially was just horrendous. It was like, I hear you guys, but I believe in the principle of openness to a range of opinions, even those we may disagree with.
That is a coward's response to that, and it's the coward's response you get from people in the UK as well. So, like, Stig Abel, when The Sun was publishing Katie Hopkins' articles, we believe in diversity of voice, when what they actually mean is we know this is good business
to
publish this kind of vitriol and hate.
The point was that their response was never consistent until Friday, because they were like, oh, he sent it to us and we published it. Actually, bollocks, they invited him to write it. And opinion editor, I can't remember, James Bennett, he's on Twitter saying, you know, this is just that we need to engage with opinions that we don't agree with. Eventually, he comes out and admits that he hadn't actually read it. He's a senior guy on the page and he hasn't read it.
I don't know if I believe that.
That's like the worst excuse ever.
But it's bullshit.
Oh, it's not.
There is one thing that I think has come out of this that is already interesting, and that is for businesses that are reliant on subscriptions and reliant on their audiences, when their audiences are not happy, they don't have to sit up and listen, because the article apparently led to the most ever subscription cancellations in an hour.
Oh, really?
And I don't want to be cynical and say that that's possibly the reason they've U-turned again on this.
Oh, I do.
Oh, but
it's that thing that when you've got that direct line to your audience, if your audience aren't happy, they will cancel.
I think the cancellation thing's an interesting one. Bob Garfield, who I love and respect a lot, said that cancelling NIT for errors of judgment and inexplicable decisions, even institutional blind spots, is like boycotting Novartis over Zolgensma, the drug scandal for Zolgensma. Basically, he's saying, you know, get one thing wrong and you know, you're not looking at all the right things that they've done. And I kind of agree with that.
Okay, but there isn't just one medication to solve this problem, is there? I mean, this is the thing now, is that there are, you know, if the New York Times screw up like this, you can go and subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, you can subscribe to the Atlantic. There are so many publications doing brilliant things.
Yeah, you probably could subscribe to the Atlantic, but you're not going to get the coverage that you get from the New York Times. They do a brilliant job. The worst part about the New York Times is their op-ed page. You know, Margaret Sullivan's brilliant on this, you know, because they've talked about reintroducing or looking at the practices and procedures that they have for this. And she says, well, here's a good one. How about you have, hey, boss, you may want to take a look at this before it runs.
I'm trying to remember this. I'm sure The Spectator published something controversial last year, and they used that same excuse that the editor was like,
"The Spectator,
controversial."
Yeah. Was it Toby Young?
Was it Rod Little?
No, I don't remember what it was last year, but it was the editor came out and said the same thing, that like he was like, "Well, I don't always agree with things, but we publish stuff basically to be a bit controversial and to get opinions that we don't necessarily agree with."
I think I do
remember
that.
Yeah. To be fair, there is something to be said for publishing pieces from people who are outside your usual readership. And there is something to be said for exposing your audience to other views. When it crosses the line, though, is when you give a platform to somebody to say, let's kill everybody who's protesting.
Also, it wasn't. I mean, it was inaccurate. The baseline he has to be accuracy. You know, he's talking about cadres of left-wing radicals like Antifa, which, you know what? You know the phrase dumpster fire?
Yeah.
I wish we had that as a UK English idiom. It's a brilliant, brilliant idiom.
Skit fire doesn't have quite the same ring to it.
No, it doesn't, does it?
No. Well, there is a good part of the story, though.
Oh, yeah?
Is there?
Yeah. How many of the Times' staff broke ranks
and criticised
the editorial direction, because historically they are, we've reported on this before, like years ago, if you are at the NYT, I think for a while you were expected to hand over your social logins.
That's right.
And you are, essentially, it is verboten from criticising the Times on social media. But everybody, I think it was what, like 800 staff writers broke ranks and said, this is unacceptable. We do not agree with this.
Well, they actually had this, they had this coordinated response as well. I saw a lot of them tweeting with the running this puts the black New York Times staff in danger.
Yeah, it does.
And it was just, it was that constant reinforcement, like, this is not okay.
Yeah, we are three white, privileged white people talking about this.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can do anything, it's got to be to call out these f**ks. So just to wrap it up, if you want an ongoing general stream of righteous indignation, there's probably no one better to follow at the moment than Thomas Bechdel on Twitter. He's all over this. And from our point of view, we'll talk about it, you know, as long as we think it's important to talk about, which is probably forever. But for now, we just want everyone to stay safe. Stay safe out there, whatever you're doing.
Moving on now to the news in brief. So the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, has announced that Tim Davie is going to replace Tony Hall as Director General. In a shock move, the BBC appointed a white man. He's the current head of BBC Studios, and he's going to take over when Hall steps down next February. Some things to point out about this: he is much more commercially minded than most of the previous Director Generals. So
he's had commercial roles with like Pepsi and stuff, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's a marketing man, really. And then he's since gone on to BBC Studios, and he's been, you know, responsible for selling rights to things like Top Gear and the BBC's biggest shows around the world. So it's potentially a sign that at least the BBC reckons it will have to be more commercially minded in the future.
So Medium apparently is launching newsletters as a new way to build relationships and share stories with your Medium audience. This is a weird one. I thought they'd been doing this for ages. And I saw a bunch of people saying, oh, Medium's pivoting in newsletters. Has Medium got any pivots left? This isn't really a pivot, is it? It's just doing more of what they've already done.
This is like an additional product for people that already use its platform. But that definitely shows that people like Substack and other places like that are putting a bit of a fire up their butt.
Interesting one. It makes me think that, I mean, who's going to be the key beneficiaries of this? Because Medium has allowed individuals more than anything else to build relationships.
Yeah.
So is this now basically saying that, you know, as Ben Thompson has done, that the individual is the brand now? Maybe I'm reaching there, but it seems like it's a leap towards that.
No, I think so, because Medium's big thing now seems to be enabling individual writers and stuff to actually make decent money off the platform and to do music.
Wow, you used that word, decent.
I said that that's their aim. I didn't say that's what they're doing. I didn't say they're succeeding at it. But in order to succeed at that, newsletters are a core component of that.
Exactly, it's a tool.
Can't really avoid Facebook news this week, but Facebook has started labelling state-controlled media pages. It did actually announce this last year, but it is now apparently actually enacting it. And this is two for the price of one for this news in brief. Zuckerberg has also defended its hands-off Trump policy to employees after walkouts and resignations last week. And I've lost track of where this has got to with Facebook now.
Gross.
Yeah, this state-controlled media pages thing, though, is nuts. It's just utterly bonkers.
It's going to get them in trouble, certainly.
Well, but it's also bullshit. Part of what they're saying, why they're saying they did this, was to stop interference in the 2020 election in the States, right?
Yeah.
But people that's going to come under this policy is people like Al Jazeera and potentially BBC.
Yeah.
Whilst Trump is still firing out the bullshit that he fires out on Facebook.
Well, speaking of Trump, which is rare, that's rare for this podcast, Snap is going to stop promoting his account after concluding that his tweets incited violence. So Snap doing what Facebook won't. Hopefully this is one thing that Facebook will copy.
So this is quite interesting, because obviously Trump hadn't actually violated any of Snap's T's and C's. But they've not blocked his account. They've just taken it off the like recommended Discover pages. Trump's response to this was hysterical. I'm not going to spoil it. You've got to look it up.
Oh, no, you have to tell me. I'm not looking it up.
So Donald Trump's campaign issued a statement that accused Snapchat of illegally using their corporate funding to rig the 2020 election. I mean, they didn't actually explain how it was illegal. It's not illegal, is it? It's a bit... No. But anyway, it was the usual kind of coherent, well-written, articulated response that you would expect.
Yeah.
I think this is good news. I'm not sure. COVID-19 has driven more than 1 million new digital subscriptions for leading news providers in the US and the UK. The average publisher has increased their digital subs by at least 15% since the end of 2019. So bad news is good news.
Anyway, layoffs have hit sports site The Athletic, with 8% of the staff losing their jobs and others taking pay cuts. And actually, I'm surprised it took them this long to make layoffs. So, I mean, it's a real shame, because they seem to be doing everything right. And they're one of those publishers that, if this hadn't happened, would be doing really, really... You know, I know they were planning, like, global expansion. So this is a real shame. But I can also imagine when sports starts back up, they should bounce back from that fairly quickly.
Yeah. I'm very surprised it took them this long. Because originally they said they weren't going to make any. Do you remember?
Yeah. Yeah, but I suppose that's been 3 months without any sport content now.
Yeah, but they've tried interesting stuff during it. They've had their journalist actually conversing one on one with subscribers, so having phone calls with them and stuff. It has been a really, really interesting.
That's a shit business model.
And we spoke about this obliquely a couple of weeks ago. A court has dismissed an appeal from several Australian media companies over a 2019 judgment that held them liable for defamatory comments posted by users on their Facebook pages in response to news articles. This is just a f***ing nightmare for news publishers.
I really do hate this story. God, it'd be nice to have a cheery news roundup for once. Oh, here's a good story. The Guardian, maybe it's not, depends on your point of view. The Guardian's rolling out global tests on a registration wall, although it's optional for now and you can dismiss it. I don't think any of us would be surprised if it became compulsory, although Casper Llewellyn Smith, the chief product officer, has assured readers the site will always be free. And I think The Guardian couldn't go anywhere without the site content always being free at some point.
Yeah, the post from Casper was quite emphatic that they would The Guardian would always be free, and that this was not acceptable to paywall. So this week I spoke to Robin Kwong, who is the Newsroom Innovation Chief at the Wall Street Journal, and I started by asking him what his job title actually involves on a day-to-day basis.
What it actually involves is that I lead a team of developers, and what we do is we build prototypes. So we build prototypes of new tools, new formats, new features, and the way that I really like to sort of think about and describe this part of the work that we do is that, you know, like, we're a newsroom innovation team, and really sort of great ideas are everywhere, and there's sort of lots of really great ideas for things that we could be doing, but what our team really tries to do is to help answer the question, should we do it, right? Should we do it as a news organization? Should we do it as a business? And where possible, we try to answer that question by actually, you know, building something and then putting it in front of people, either to get their verbal feedback on it or just look at the data of how they're using it, and really sort of actually, I would say that actually the core output of our team is actually the insights and the data and the analytics that comes out of showing prototypes to people rather than the prototypes themselves.
Okay. So does the Wall Street Journal have big goals that you kind of try and work towards, or do you guys literally just kind of throw spaghetti at the wall, see what works, and then integrate that in?
Yep. I mean, it can feel like we're throwing spaghetti at the wall sometimes, but no, like any other sort of big organization, the Wall Street Journal has some big broad strategic goals, and I don't think they're going to be a surprise to anyone, really. They're quite commonsensical. So, you know, we want to grow our readership, we want to diversify our readership, and I think we want to engage more deeply with the readers that we already have, right? And so when we as a team take a look at what projects we take on, sort of what prototypes to build, what ideas to pursue, that is one of the considerations, right? We keep an eye out on, you know, what are the possible ways in which this thing that we're doing could contribute to one of the strategic goals. So that's definitely one of the considerations, but I think I'm also quite mindful of the fact that part of the role of an innovation team and sort of why you know, why we have that in our name is to create some space for creativity and for figuring out what the right questions to ask are. And so we have these big, broad strategic goals in mind, sort of in the back of our heads, but we're not, compared to some of the other teams at the Journal, we're less sort of specifically beholden to, you know, having to hit this numerical target in this quarter.
Okay. When you're sort of building things and you're looking to release things, do you just test them on like a really small portion of the site before wider release? Like how much actually ends up getting and actually integrating into the Wall Street Journal site?
Well, one of the things we've built actually sort of goes out to practically everyone. So if you go to the Wall Street Journal homepage, you'll have seen sort of since coronavirus started that we now have this gray ribbon, gray bar at the top that highlights the free to read content, the free resources that the Wall Street Journal has. And that was a really sort of a very, very quick prototype that we built when we were given the challenge or the question was posed to our team of like, you know, the Journal has operated a pretty strict paywall for a pretty long time. But with the pandemic coming, the higher ups decided, you know, we really should make some of the key essential content free to read, but how are people going to find it, you know? We went really for the most obvious solution, which is, you know, smack bang in the middle of the homepage. So there are some things that really sort of go out quite publicly. But actually, our team's quite new. So I joined the team in December. And one of the questions that we are trying to figure out as we go along is the different ways in which we could test ideas, right? So obviously, when something goes out as publicly as that ribbon, there are a bunch of quality control, a bunch of sort of layers to go through before you can put something on the site. Whereas if we're testing something with a smaller group of people, we can act a bit quicker, we can be a bit more scrappy, we can adjust things as we go along. Trying to figure out different ways of testing with different groups of people is actually something that's pretty high up on my mind for at least last couple of months.
And your background is reporting and data journalism. Mm. So how have you got to this stage, which sounds a little bit more kind of technical?
Yeah, I guess I've always been interested in new things, in sort of using new ways to tell stories, to do journalism. And I've always really been interested in how people work together. And in the course of my career and in sort of the course of thinking about, you know, what is the job that I should be doing? Where can I have the most impact? It's just sort of gradually evolved from working in journalism to trying to work sort of on how we do journalism. I think being on the interactive news team at the FT was one of the transition points of where I actually was working with technology. I felt like I needed to learn how to code. And then sort of moving on, realizing that actually the people that I really want to help the most, that I really like the most, are my fellow reporters and editors. And sort of figuring out how to use technology to help them is something that, you know, I'm quite passionate about. And it just sort of gradually led down this road into working on the technology that delivers the journalism itself.
And do you get quite involved with the technical side of that? Or are you more, is it more leadership and you're leading a technical team?
These days I'm completely unqualified to touch any of the technical bits. It's mostly leading the team. It's as I mentioned, we're quite a new team, so it's a lot of time spent sort of setting up and thinking about, you know, what is the purpose of our team, what is the mission, how do we measure our success, and that sort of thinking really goes from thinking about the team as a whole down to the individual projects. A large part of the other part of what our team does, which I haven't really spoken a lot about up until this point, is we don't really want to own innovation at the Journal, actually. We want to be able to empower innovation. I mean, if you think about sort of what does a healthy, agile, you know, adaptable, innovative company look like, it's people experimenting and trying new things regardless of sort of which position they're working in, right? You don't really want to silo it all into just one team. So we try to work really collaboratively with a lot of other teams. We try to help other teams when they are trying to do something new and just sort of structuring their approach and their thinking. So, asking, what is the hypothesis that you're testing? If you think about this as an experiment instead of just a new feature that we have to build or a new product we have to launch, and how will you know if you've either proven or disproven it? And, you know, reminding people after launch, for example, that what about looking at the data and communicating it and sort of helping a lot with the sort of framing of the work and helping a lot of the communication of the work? That's also part of what we do. So since my team, you know, other than me, are developers, that's quite a lot of what I do day in, day out.
So you're kind of almost the educator for the rest of the business.
It sounds a bit grand when you put it that way, but I think that's that's what I would like to be able to help with. Yeah.
Yeah. So what does success look like for the team?
I think the success looks like several things. One is that this relates partly back to that question of like, what are the right groups of people to test on, and what are the right ways of testing something? I think success looks like having a stable environment for experimentation and prototyping, right? Having sort of almost playbooks, almost sort of knowing exactly what we need to do to test something and being able to carry that out. And I think we're still in the early stages of establishing what that looks like. So that's really quite a specific goal for my team, you know, specifically. More broadly, I think success looks like lots of other teams at the journal feeling like they have the freedom to try new things, have also a set of processes and a way of doing it, or at least know who they can turn to for help when they want to try new things. And I think success looks like, from the outside, the journal looking like a company that is constantly evolving. You know, it's adapting and it's changing and is sort of really unafraid to fail. I think that's probably actually one of the harder things for anyone in any organization working in innovation.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about any of the other features you've launched recently, apart from the coronavirus bar?
Yep. So I think let me do a fun one, and then I'll talk about one that really I think has had a quite a big impact. So the fun one is we launched WSJ Jigsaw. So this is digital jigsaw puzzles. The journal has had for a long time, a really loyal crossword puzzle community and following. And we know that playing the crossword puzzle actually is a really engaging, you know, the people who play puzzles are deeply engaged with the journal. And so we thought, actually, what if we could expand, since everybody's working from home now, they're sitting in front of the computer, what if we could expand the range of puzzles that we have at the journal? And how do we make something like a jigsaw puzzle, which is, you know, people are familiar with, it's quite common, been around for a long time, how do we make it distinctly WSJ? And so what we did is we took the head cuts. These are the stipple drawings that go with the A head articles. There's one of the things I've learned is I have to learn a lot of jargon since coming into a different company. But the A head is a generally slightly humorous article on the front page that sort of illuminates a slice of life. And it's marked in the print paper by a hand-drawn stipple drawing of the subject of the A head. And if you've been at the journal for a long time and you become a columnist, then you also get an A head, you also get a stipple drawing, you also get a head cut sometimes. So we decided to, we realized we had these archives of really quite lovely and quite distinctively Wall Street Journal images. And we thought, what if we took them and we made them into digital jigsaw puzzles that people can play? This one that we actually worked with one of our graphics editors who was working from home, had some free time, and found a JavaScript library that is open source but hasn't been updated for a long time to turn images into jigsaw puzzles. And he sort of worked with the code, updated it, and worked with our team to launch it just to make sure that everything is sort of, you know, passes all the right checks and all of that. And that's been really fun for some people. We've been gathering feedback on the puzzle itself, and people are saying, you know, make it harder. We want more images. can you have it in color as well? So that's been quite fun. The other one that I'll talk a bit about is one that I really think has had a big impact, which is, and it sounds really simple in concept, right? Which is we launched a tool to let reporters and editors create and embed feedback forms into stories.
Okay.
It's like Google Forms basically, but sort of embeddable within a Wall Street Journal story. And then also we figured out and are working on all of the back end stuff that happens afterwards, right? So, you know, where do the responses go? How do the reporters and editors actually view it? What do we do with personally identifiable information and all that sort of stuff? And that's had a really big impact because we worked really closely with our audiences teams and our audience voice teams. And reporters and editors have been using that as a call out for tips, as a way of asking our audience and our readers, you know, what more do they want to read about a story? What questions might they have that we could help them answer? And I think it's been a really important, it's been used in dozens of stories, and we've gotten sort of hundreds and thousands of responses. I think it's been a really important tool in almost sort of invisibly sort of shifting us towards being a more, I guess, sort of member engagement type of organization, of making the journalism a bit more of a two-way conversation between the journalists and the readers, rather than just a one-way broadcast.
Is that not open to a little bit of abuse?
Yeah. So we've had to figure out some of the, well, so there's two things. One is that unlike the comments section, the feedback form, the responses doesn't get published. It's just instead of a person emailing the reporter directly, they fill out a form and it goes to the reporters, and we have all the disclaimers and in the form itself around sort of what we do with your personal data, how we gather them, and all of that. But even then, I mean, I think so one of the technical bits of work that we've had to do is to realize that, well, when reporters and editors ask these questions and they get responses, they want to use them to do their work, which means sharing them with other reporters and editors within the same organization. Of course, we would never share it outside. But even then, because of data protection laws and privacy laws, like, we have to be really careful about people's identifiable details. So there's a lot of work gone into sort of figuring out how we can set up a system that almost sort of automatically strips out those and hides them, so that the reporters only see the non-identifiable sort of responses. In fact, I would say that, you know, this is a small example. I would say that a lot of the times, the work that our team does, and a lot of sort of what's really hard about coming up with new things and doing new things, is actually figuring out these sorts of sort of, they seem like smallish questions.
It's
like
all the little details. Because,
yeah, it's all the little details, right? And really putting the work in to figure that out is the difference between a tool that can be used widely and a tool that, you know, you put it out without having thought about it, and then 2 months later you get a complaint and then it all has to be shut down.
Yeah. Do you have comment sections as well, or is it literally just those forms now?
So we had comment sections, and the work on the comment section happened a bit before I arrived and a bit before our team got set up. That is a large part of the genesis of the audience voice teams, which was that comments, was just sort of generally open at the journal previously, and they were quite toxic. You know, there were a lot of negative comments. There was a lot of people, it actually actively turned people off from reading the journal because they say, I go to the comments and it's terrible. So the audience voice teams was set up, I think, about 18 months ago now, to really try to figure out and solve that problem. And so there's a combination of really manual curation at the beginning, and then also working with the R&D team, which is a separate but sits next to us, which works really closely with AI and machine learning, to use some of that technology to do an initial filtering and to do a sort of sentiment analysis on the comments to help the work of the moderators. So that meant that we went from initially only opening up a handful of articles for comments, because that was the capacity that we had for moderating them, to being able to almost by default open most articles now, because moderators on the audience voice team is able to use the technology to really sort of help speed up their work.
Yeah, and filter out the garbage before it gets to you.
Yeah.
And I know that at the moment, everybody's all over the world. Geography doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter where you live. But when you first joined this team, you were in London, but you're working for a primarily US brand. And I assume most of the team are in the US.
Yep.
So how does that work practically?
Yeah, it's been interesting. So I'm actually meant to be in New York. I was hired to work out of New York. It's just that it just hasn't really worked out that way because of the pandemic. I'm still in the process of applying for my U.S. work visa. I will say that it was quite interesting, a little bit tough in the beginning couple of months, because I joined in December last year because of this situation, right? Because I was the only one out in London, 5 hours ahead. Everybody else, the team, were in New York, and they're all going to the same office. Funnily enough, since everybody has had to work from home, it's actually been a little bit of a blessing in disguise. My team has had 3-4 months of getting used to me not being there, in a sense, or me being there remotely, that when everybody went remote, it was, I hope, sort of an easier time for them to adjust. I'm still hoping to make it out to New York, but who knows.
And you've got a Wall Street Journal DXS medium publication for the company. So what was the thinking behind having something that's kind of forward-facing about some of the work you do?
So DXS stands for Digital Experiences and Strategy, which is the name for the sort of big, broad department that my team is under, as well as a lot of our product teams, our technology teams, our design teams. I think, you know... As a journalist, as a reporter and editor before, you know, your work is really public. You know, I write a story and it goes out and everybody can see it. Some of the work that our tech and design and product colleagues do isn't really as visible most of the times. And I'm not just sort of saying that for publicly, but actually internally sometimes is not sort of super visible as well. You know, people sit on different floors when we're all in the offices, don't really sort of know what the other people are doing. And so we thought that having a blog where we could celebrate some of the new projects, some of the new thinking, some of the work that we do is good for, for empowering innovation generally. But also I think that there's a lot that different organizations could learn from each other. You know, like even before I started doing this job, I was reading the New York Times, you know, engineering blog and seeing what they're doing, and the Washington Post's equivalent blog. And so I think a lot of us, you know, we're at different organizations are all tackling, you know, fairly similar problems, actually. And, you know, where possible, being able to write about what we've done to celebrate it, to sort of help others if we can, is just a really good thing.
Although that's got to be quite tough choosing, you know, you almost don't want to give away too many secrets.
Yes. We can't really go into some of the nitty gritty details in some of them. But then I think also... some of the most recent posts we had was about how the Audience Voices team came up with 7 or 8 new ways of engaging readers during the coronavirus pandemic, right? So some of that is actually sort of already quite public-facing work. It's just that if you haven't been involved in that specific initiative, if you are not typically a Wall Street Journal subscriber, on the internet especially, you only sort of really see slices of things. So there's lots of stuff that's actually public and out there, but you only ever come into contact with a small proportion of it. So being able to sort of flag those up, to put them all in one place, to sort of say, hey, actually, here's a range of initiatives that we've done. I think that's quite good.
Lovely. And as you know, we ask all our guests what the last thing is you read, watched, or saw that really affected you.
So this was actually literally from a couple of days ago, and I struggle a bit to describe what it actually is. It's a mobile game. It's a narrative game. It's an interactive novel almost, but it has nothing to do with the coronavirus. But it's called If Found. Yep. It's called If Found, and I played it on my iPhone. You can download it from the App Store there. And it's a fictional story about a young woman who's 23 years old and returns to her hometown in Ireland. And the story is told through her journals, and it's just a really touching story about loss, about processing what's happened to you, about identity. And I was particularly interested in it because I think there's a large part of the storytelling that happens through you as a player and your interactions with the game and sort of what you actually do with your fingers on the screen, rather than just through sort of words and images alone. And so I thought that was really great.
Okay, so you need to get the Media Voices daily media roundup every single day. There's a month's worth of issues out there that you can look at and see if we're doing a good job. Spoiler, we are. You can sign up.
Patting ourselves on the back for that.
Well, virtually nobody's unsubscribed yet.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Yes.
You can sign up on our website, voices.media. We promise we'll be succinct and add value to your day. The top three or four stories you need to know every day that'll make you better at your job. Or at least you'll know what to talk about when you go for a coffee.
You can get that by going to voices.media and signing up there. While you're there, you may as well listen to our archive. We have, 4 years now of effectively time capsules for media moments throughout the year. You can also check out some of our conversations episodes and just learn a little bit more about your three hosts.
And if you want to get a constant stream of media news that we read throughout the day, you can follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod, where we post all the links we've talked about this week and more.
But this week, please do stay safe, do sign up to our daily newsletter, and we'll see you next week for another podcast edition of Media Voices.
Stay angry too. I feel like we need people to stay angry at the minute.
Yeah. And if you're like,
turn it into something positive.
And if you're privileged like us, do the work.